Welcome to a podcast of a primer on predatory open access scholarly publishers, presented by Jeffrey Beal. This podcast was recorded at the 2013 TA Conference in Reno, Nevada.
The talk will cover the four models of scholarly journal publishing, predatory publishers and their characteristics, a detailed description of the weaknesses of the gold open access model, a discussion of the open access movement, and a discussion of licensing. And if you don't understand any of those terms, hopefully you will be an expert in them by the end of this talk. So first, I'd like to tell you a little bit about me. I'm the Scholarly Initiatives Librarian at the University of Colorado, Denver. I work at Auraria Library there. My work involves working with library colleagues to inform the campus about scholarly communication and issues related to it. My library is located in downtown Denver. And if you've ever been to the Convention Center in Denver, the Auraria campus is right behind it. The campus is operated by a state agency and hosts three institutions of higher learning, including my university, a smaller university, and a community college. They all share the same library, and the library is operated by the University of Colorado Denver on behalf of all three schools. Throughout most of my library career, my research focused on the weaknesses of full-text searching and the strengths of metadata-enabled searching. The two biggest problems in information discovery I found were homonyms and synonyms, and many high-quality databases are set up to deal with these hurdles, such as for synonyms, when you search for false teeth in a database, the database may offer you a cross-reference that says, see dentures. Regarding homonyms, if you search for boxers, the computer doesn't know if you mean the dog, the fighter, or the underwear. So databases create unique terms for each concept, separating them out and enabling better search precision. Since 2009, my research focus has gradually changed, and I now dedicate my research efforts to the study of predatory open access publishers, and that's what this talk is about, and I'll explain it fully here in a second. Let me quickly define predatory publishers now, and I'll give a fuller definition in a minute. Predatory publishers are those journal publishers that abuse the author pays model of scholarly publishing. They charge scholarly authors a fee whenever they accept a paper for publication in one of their journals. The unintended consequences of having financial transactions between authors and publishers has corrupted some publishers who now accept just about anything for money, essentially becoming scholarly vanity presses. This is the focus of my research. People often ask me how I came to be interested in predatory publishers, and the answer is that I was intrigued by the spam emails I started to receive in 2008 asking me to submit papers to open access journals. I had worked as a library cataloger for many years, so I had a bibliographic interest in this new publishing mode. I began to save the emails, and I created my first list in 2010, but it was on an old blog, and it was ignored. I never planned to research predatory publishers. It just happened slowly after I began to receive and save copies of the spam emails. Beginning in 2009, I started to write occasional reviews of predatory publishers in the library-oriented journal called The Charleston Advisor, published in South Carolina. This journal reviews commercial databases that libraries license, but also reviews some open access products. It was in a review published there in 2010 that I coined the term predatory publisher. My blog is called Scholarly Open Access, and it has the subtitle Critical Analysis of Scholarly Open Access Publishing. Its address is scholarlyoa.com. The main part of the blog contains two lists, one of predatory publishers and one of predatory standalone journals. Increasingly, many mega journals are being established, each with a broad scope, but they are not under the aegis of any publisher. I also author about two blog posts per week, usually describing new publishers that I've recently added to my lists. I think my blog and the two lists are a study in how an academic blog can have a positive impact. The mission of my blog is to help scholars avoid being victims of publishing scams. I am approaching 1 million views, with the busiest day so far having been 46,000 views, and this was the day an article that mentioned my work appeared in the New York Times. I'm grateful to have lots of help from others in writing and maintaining my blog. I regularly receive many tips from scholars pointing out new potential predatory journals and forwarding me their spam. I like to get spam. Many also have given me constructive help on the structure and content of the blog. So first I'll begin by describing the four most important scholarly publishing distribution models. We're all aware of what's been called the traditional or subscription model. This is for journals, a model that can be used for both print and online journals. Some now refer to the subscription model as the toll access model. There are several advantages to this model. One advantage of the print model, and we didn't even realize this was an advantage, is that you purchase the content in perpetuity. You don't have to license it for some time. Also, because journals using the traditional model have limited space, only the very best papers could get accepted and published in them. Another advantage was the validation function aligned with this low acceptance rate. Everyone knew that if someone got a paper published in one of these journals, it had to be a good paper. Your work was validated by the publishing process. Finally, one of the good things about the print model was that it spread the cost of publishing over many, often thousands of subscribers, keeping costs lower per subscriber. I'm not trying to argue for a return to print. It's expensive, can be used by only one person at a time, is subject to theft or loss. But whatever model the academic community moves to ought to retain somehow. The great strengths of the traditional scholarly publishing model. One of the things that fostered the creation of the open access movement was the high cost of print subscriptions. But the publishers dealt with this high cost by creating what we librarians call the big deal, capital B, capital D. That is, packages of journals at highly discounted prices. Now libraries don't have to subscribe to journals individually anymore and can purchase these big deal packages at a great cost savings. And this model also greatly increased the number of titles that libraries could afford and provide access to. Now I'd like to describe the gold open access model. In this model, an article processing charge, or APC, is charged to the author upon acceptance of a scholarly manuscript by a journal publisher. All gold open access journals are freely available online. Sometimes this is called the author pays model, or more sarcastically, pay to say. I first noticed publishers using this model in 2008. Unlike the traditional model, which spreads the cost of publishing around, this model focuses the cost on the authors, a much smaller group than the subscribers if it were a subscription journal. This is problematic because most scholars are consumers of research much more than they are creators of it. You might publish one paper a year but read 100. In the gold open access model, consumers contribute nothing to the cost of publishing. The costs are all borne by the authors. Of course, it's a great thing to be able to have free access to scholarly research if you are one of the specialists that can understand it. So this is the advantage of the gold model. It's opened up research to those in the third world, for example, but for them, paying the article processing charges can be a problem. Many publishers claim that they waive fees for authors submitting from low-income countries. The problem is that the authors from middle-income countries are often thrown out of the game because there are not enough grant funds in their countries to cover the article processing charges, and they can't afford to pay the fees themselves, which can be over $2,000. I'll have a lot more to say about gold open access in a minute. And the next model is called the Platinum Open Access model, and it's basically the same as the gold model, except that there are no author fees. The model is funded benevolently, either subsidized by an organization or by volunteer work or some combination of both. I don't have any problem with this model, and there are some very fine journals that operate using it. Finally, there's the green open access model. This model involves authors self-archiving their work on open access repositories, usually institutional repositories sponsored by their institutions or disciplinary repositories, usually funded by scholarly organizations. Green open access usually involves authors publishing in traditional journals, closed access journals or toll access, and then getting permission from the publisher to self-archive their work in a repository, thus making it open access. Normally, the publishers don't grant permission for the final PDF version of the article to be archived. So the author is usually granted permission to either post the preprint, which is the author's version in Word before it went through peer review, or the postprint, which is the author's final version in Word before he submits the final version of the paper to the publisher. Green open access has one vocal champion in the UK, and it suffers from a low uptake by authors and thus requires mandates to work effectively. I think the goal of Green Open Access is to get authors accustomed to publishing their work openly in repositories, thereby making publishers unnecessary. But any model that requires mandates on authors to be successful is doomed to failure, I think. Next, I'd like to talk about predatory publishers and what they do. Predatory publishers are those that abuse the Gold Open Access model for their own profit. As I indicated, the Gold Open Access model works by the author paying a fee upon acceptance of his paper for publication in a journal. This means that the more papers a journal accepts, the more money it earns. This conflict of interest is too tempting for many, and they accept papers that don't deserve to be called science just to earn the author fee. Since December 2011, when my blog first became well-known, I have seen this abuse of Gold Open Access, of the Gold Open Access publishing model, grow exponentially in terms of the number of new publishers being established. Unlike in the past, it's now extremely easy for a publisher to set up shop. Basically, all you need is a website and some unique journal titles. Under the traditional print model, becoming a new publisher required a large investment and presented a significant capital risk. Moreover, to be successful over time, you had to keep your subscribers happy. Not anymore. These days, you can set up a new publisher in a day, and I've seen it done. Regarding the criteria for determining which publishers or standalone journals are predatory, I publish this on my blog. Actually, I'm currently on the second edition of the criteria because after I published the first one in 2012, I received a lot of helpful advice and criteria, and I took this advice and came up with a much better criteria document that I published in December 2012. It's great. This is a copy of it, part of it, and it's the current edition of it. And I also have full copies if anybody wants one, which I was going to give out at the group discussion. The intent of my list is to include basically only the worst of the worst. If a publisher is borderline, that is, if it's really difficult to decide whether it's predatory or not, then I do not add it to the list. I realize that there are honest upstart publishers, who may be a little sloppy and make mistakes at the beginning, and I endeavor not to include these journals or publishers on my list. Generally speaking, the criteria look at deceptive and non-transparent behavior on the part of publishers. If you're deceptive or if you hide information that publishers conventionally provide, then you may find your publisher on my list. I've reviewed books for the Magazine Library Journal for over 10 years. I review science books, especially books about astronomy, earthquakes, volcanoes, and severe weather. Most of my reviews have been positive, but a few have been negative. I see my work with predatory publishers as a reviewing function. I engage in critical thinking about the publishers and share my thinking, my reviews of them with the world. And I encourage all academic librarians to share their critical thinking with the world. Here are some of the specific criteria that I use when I examine and analyze potential predatory publishers. One, the journal does not identify a formal editorial or review board. Two, the publisher has no policies or practices for digital preservation. Three, the publisher begins operation with a large fleet of journals, often using a template to quickly create each journal's homepage. Four, the publisher provides insufficient information or hides information about author fees, offering to publish an author's paper and later sending a previously undisclosed invoice. Next, the name of a journal does not adequately reflect its origin. And finally, the journal falsely claims to have an impact factor or uses some made-up measure like view factor, feigning international standing. And there's a lot more. I've been studying Gold Open Access since 2009, and as I mentioned, and I have documented what I believe are the weaknesses of the model, and here they are. These are the weaknesses of the Gold Open Access publishing model. The first is research misconduct. I think that author misconduct may occur more frequently in Gold Open Access because of the conflict of interest. Publishers want to earn the money from the author fees, so they accept anything. I think that predatory publishers increase the amount of author misconduct or research misconduct that ends up being published. Many predatory publishers do not check for plagiarism before they publish papers. Many do not even put their papers through an honest peer review. The result is that predatory publishers' articles are a breeding ground for research misconduct. They are filled with plagiarism, self-plagiarism, image and data manipulation, salami slicing, which is breaking up a research project into least publishable units and publishing each as a separate article, ghost authorship, which is when someone helps contribute to a paper but is not properly credited for it, and honorary authorship, which is when someone is listed as a co-author but didn't contribute to the paper. Do these instances of author misconduct occur with traditional publishers? Yes, of course they do, but with traditional publishers, peer review essentially continues forever, as we've seen by following the fascinating blog called Retraction Watch. Fellow scientists find and report errors and misconduct in published works and report them to the publisher. Then an investigation is conducted, and the misconduct is dealt with, often by retracting the article. In the case of predatory publishers, it's rare that they even investigate instances of reported misconduct. I've tried. I sometimes test potential predatory publishers by documenting plagiarism in one or more of their articles and reporting it to them. Sometimes there's no reply and the plagiarism remains. Often the publishers will give me the runaround, resulting in no real attempt to address the plagiarism. I've also seen the publishers blame the issue on the authors and fail to address it themselves. In a sense, I understand their approach because authors are supposed to warrant their work is original upon submission, but publishers need to have standard policies for dealing with misconduct that's discovered and reported, and most of the predatory publishers do not. Another weakness of the gold open access model is fake or insufficient peer review. Papers get published as science but have not gone through a science's quality control mechanism, which is peer review. I've been forwarded emails from publishers to authors whose papers were accepted with no real peer review. It's difficult to document fake peer review because the publishers that do it are not transparent. We know that research is cumulative. New research builds on previous research as recorded in the scholarly record. One of the roles of peer review is to ensure that only sound science gets included in scientific journals. I want to discuss the terms demarcation and boundary work. Demarcation deals with differentiating true science from non-science and pseudoscience. One of the purposes of peer review, then, is demarcation. Because many predatory publishers do a fake or non-existent peer review, much non-science is being published as if it were real science. This non-science later gets cited in other scientific articles, and the result is a breakdown of the scientific process. Articles in quality journals may be contaminated with citations from bogus journals, journals that never conducted an honest peer review. Boundary work is action taken by scientists to enforce demarcation, that is, to enforce the distinction between science and non-science, and to actively work to protect science from pseudoscience. Astronomers do this when they denounce astrology, for example. Next, open access publishers can disappear completely, or they can change their model to subscription access. The predatory publisher called Eurojournals, which of course was not based in Europe but in Mauritius, recently took all its content offline and became a toll access publisher. They told everyone that it would be available through EBSCO's EconLit database, but I'm able to confirm that the content is really there, and I can confirm that it is gone from the open internet. So all the article processing charges that people paid to have their content published in this publisher's 33 journals is lost, as is the content itself. I think this scenario will repeat itself with variations throughout the coming years. Many of the predatory publishers are one-man operations, and when the man is gone or gets bored with it, the journals disappear forever. Predatory publishers prey on junior faculty, graduate students, and postdocs. These are the people most unfamiliar with scholarly publishing. So they are the chief targets of bogus scholarly publishers. One of their very successful strategies is to send personalized spam emails. In these emails, they write to a researcher and praise one or more of his earlier works, and then they invite the researcher to submit a new work to their journal. They don't mention the article processing charge in the email. Then the researcher submits a paper, and it's quickly accepted and published, and then a week or so, the publisher sends the researcher an invoice for the article processing charge. This is usually the point at which the author sends me an email asking me what to do. And here is one email I received. Quote, I'm a junior doctor in the UK, and I received an email from the Omics Publishing Group saying that they could offer a rapid peer review process for publishing of academic articles. I went to their website, and it seemed fairly ordinary. I read the instructions for authors and sent off my manuscript in the required format. A couple of months later, I received an email from Omics saying that my article had been accepted for publication, and could I check the proof and pay the author fee? To my horror, I opened the file to find an invoice for $2,700. This fee was not mentioned anywhere obvious at the time I submitted my manuscript, and I have never come across anything like this before. I sent an email saying I could not pay and wanted to withdraw my article. They replied saying, as I now have been assigned a DOI, it is not possible to withdraw, and I can pay the fee in installments. Then the business about the DOI is not true. They only cost a dollar. Finally, she said, do I legally have to pay this enormous fee, and could I be in any sort of legal trouble if I do not pay? I've received almost the same email dozens of times. I usually advise people not to pay the fee and to demand that the paper be withdrawn. There are several publishers that have become experts at exploiting junior faculty using this strategy. One of them is Omics Publishing Group, based in Hyderabad, India. We need to consider the societal uses of published research. It is cited in legal cases. It is translated into clinical practice. Journalists cover research in the media, and public policymakers use it to make public policy. Textbooks writers base what they write on research recorded in the academic record. Thus, it's crucial that any work bearing the imprimatur of science be true and accurate, peer-reviewed science. Unfortunately, the predatory publishers are publishing bogus science, and this may affect these societal uses of it by poisoning the well of science. One of the main characteristics of the Gold Open Access model is that it is author-centric. The traditional model is reader-centric. Authors want short review times, so journals cater to this. Readers want quality literature, so traditional journals cater to this. Traditional journals always had to earn their subscriptions from the subscribers, and this was not easy. With open access, everyone has access, so this concern has become obsolete. Open access publishers really care only about the authors, the source of their revenue. I am sometimes asked who the victims of predatory publishers are. I respond by saying the victims of predatory publishers are researchers, science communication, and science itself. Another weakness of the Gold Open Access model is that scholarly societies in the arts and humanities and social sciences suffer under the Gold model. These learned societies usually publish a small fleet of journals, and they had reasonable subscription prices, and many, many libraries and others subscribe to their journals. The cost of publishing the journals was very spread out among all the subscribers. The learned societies generally generated a little surplus from their publishing programs that they used to subsidize their other programs, such as conferences and scholarships for new researchers in their fields. The number of scholarly articles being published is increasing almost exponentially. This means it's harder for scholars to keep up and filter out the unneeded stuff. Another problem is complicit authors. Some scholarly authors have gone over to the dark side and take advantage of the weaknesses in the system. They utilize the predatory publishers as scholarly vanity presses and submit low-quality work to them just to meet their yearly quota or to get enough publications to get a promotion or make tenure. The advent of predatory publishers has changed the work of conscientious tenure committees a lot. They now have to closely scrutinize the publications of tenure candidates, judging the quality of each. One of the tricks the predatory publishers use is to give legitimate-sounding titles to their journals and their publishing houses. The journals usually have the word international in their titles, and the publishers also use terms like global, world, American, British, Australian to name their operations and their journals. They are very good at appearing legitimate. That's how they make their money, looking good and attracting those author fees. Okay, so again, before I close up on the weaknesses of Gold Open Access, I will say that there are benefits to scholarly open access publishing. There is no charge to access the content. It's free. There is some evidence of a citation advantage and a readership advantage to open access, and this is called the Open Access Citation Effect, OACE. Some studies indicate that open access articles get cited more than articles published behind a paywall. Okay, the open access movement. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about the open access movement itself. I talked about the open access publishing model, but there's also an open access movement, a social movement. This social movement is very vocal, and it doesn't like anything less than complete dedication to open access and complete destruction of traditional publishers. Some of the idealists in the OA movement don't like me pointing out the weaknesses of open access. These adherents tend to be anti-capitalist collectivists. Their idea of a good time is organizing a new boycott of Elsevier. The movement is stronger in Europe, where open access publishing is enshrined in national law, especially in the UK. In Europe, most research, like pretty much everything else there, is funded by the government, so the government can make demands on the researchers who accept the research grants, although this is also true in the US. There's also a lot of discord within the open access movement. There is one very vocal person who's promoting the green model and who trashes the gold model, a situation that fills up email lists with about open access with volleys of tendentious communication. The Europeans do not like the idea of one person, me, deciding which publishers are predatory. They think such an activity is best left to a government commission. Some Europeans claim that I am making the predatory publishing problem seem bigger than it really is. And they also claim that scholars have no problem distinguishing publishing scams from legitimate operations. But I have not found this to be true, and the problem is indeed a big one. Researchers are growing tired of getting incessant spam emails from predatory publishers. These spam emails clog inboxes and reduce productivity. The emails seek article submissions, editorial board service, and ad hoc reviews of submitted papers, though the review requests are generally sent to the wrong researcher, such as when an economist gets a chemistry paper to review. Now I'd like to talk about the licensing of open access scholarly publishing. The standard that is promoted by the open access stalwarts is the Creative Commons Attribution License, also known by its nickname as CC BY or CC BY. This license is a broad waiving of one's rights to a work he has created. It allows commercial use, and it allows derivative works like translations to be made. The CC BY license is mostly promoted by Europeans, of course, but there is some pushback beginning to appear in North America. Many object to commercial use being unrestricted, especially for works in the health sciences. There is a certain Euro dominance in the entire open access movement that is unsettling to me. The Europeans are pushing a publishing model that panders to authors instead of meeting the needs of readers. Before I close, I'd like to discuss some of the attacks on me. In December of last year, I was the victim of a criminal impersonation campaign carried out by one of the publishers on my list. He used the email spoofing technique, sending out emails to all the publishers on my list, with the emails appearing as if they were from me, including looking as if they came from my personal email account. The emails offered to remove the publisher from the list for a $5,000 fee. In addition to sending out the emails, they also posted copies of them all over the internet, and this is part of one, including on bogus blogs and other social media sites. Many of them are still there. I learned that criminals respond in criminal ways. I've been affected by some legal maneuvering as well. In February of this year, I got an email and a 200-page fax sent at night threatening to sue me if I did not remove the four publishing brands of the Canadian Center of Science and Education from my list and pay $10,000 to the publisher. I learned the difference between a threatening letter and a lawsuit, and fortunately, in this case, the lawsuit has never been filed, and I didn't remove him from my list. Also, earlier this year, I requested an investigation about some possible plagiarism that might have been carried out by a professor at a university in Maryland. Note how I t- talk very carefully about plagiarism now. The professor was the chair of the ethics board at his city's main school district and was a professor, and still is, a professor of accounting at this university. The story made the front page of the Baltimore Sun. A couple weeks later, I was called into the university counsel's office and told that were this to turn into a lawsuit, that the university would not represent me because reporting plagiarism is outside the scope of my job duties. And I'd become on a first-name basis with the university lawyer at this time. I've also had some university communications staff express concern that the university system president and the university chancellor and, God forbid, the university regents might learn about my research from press reports. In short, the communications office only likes to report on happy things and not about the real world of research. I wish that my university would be more true to the ideals of academic freedom and place those ahead of public relations. Recently, the Omix Publishing Group threatened to sue me for $1 billion unless I remove all my blog posts about them, remove them from my list, and pay them $10,000 and apologize. They also threatened to press criminal charges against me in India. As far as I know, no suit has been filed. The attention that this threat generated harmed the company by drawing attention to its many weaknesses and questionable practices. Here are some questions that I often get asked. Is there anything we can do to stop these predatory publishers? The answer is no, because in most cases, they're not doing anything illegal. They enjoy the same freedom of press that we all enjoy. Their violations are ethical rather than legal. Next question, what about publishers using the subscription model that engage in predatory behaviors? Yes, traditional publishers do sometimes also commit unethical acts, but I enjoy academic freedom, a privilege that gives me the right to study what I want to study, and I don't want to study that. Three, why don't you create a white list instead of a black list? A blacklist is better, in my opinion, because it's a quicker way to get information to scholars. As soon as acts of deception or lack of needed transparency are detected, I can add a publisher to my list. A white list might take longer, forcing a publisher to prove its operations are legitimate, a process that can be lengthy. The mission of my list is to help scholarly authors avoid publishing scams, and the best way I found to do this is by creating a blacklist. Before I conclude, because I discussed self-plagiarism earlier in my talk, I need to tell you that a small portion of the content in this talk is taken from two other talks I gave earlier this summer. I could not think of a better way to say it or show it in the case of the slides. Thus, I am hereby orally citing myself, grateful that there was no requirement that my work be totally original. Interesting thing about the copyright talk this morning is self-plagiarism is often an example of a copyright violation, because you publish it in one journal and then you write a second article in another journal, include some of your content from the first journal, and both are copyrighted. Self-plagiarism can be an example of a copyright infringement, and the publishers get stuck with it. So to conclude, predatory publishers are corrupting the open access movement and are poisoning scholarly communication itself. More information is not better information. The valuable validation feature that the traditional publishers offered is being lost, and the gold open access model is slowly failing. Science itself is in jeopardy as the corruption of the gold open access model threatens the future of research. Please help your academic colleagues by publishing your good work in only the finest venues and resist the temptation to take the easy road, publishing with the scholarly vanity presses. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take easy questions. Yes.
Is there a parallel that you know of for managing predatory compost?
Yes. In fact, many of the publishers that I study also offer conferences, and they charge very high registration fees, and then they invite the authors to submit their papers presented at the conference to the journals where they make more money. I don't have time to cover all the conferences. I wish somebody would do what I'm doing for conferences. Nobody's really doing it right now. Omix is one of the worst. They charge a lot of money. What they do is they rent several rooms at like a DoubleTree hotel. So they have the chemistry conference and the medical biology conference, and each one will be in one room, and they're making a lot of money So there's a lot of corrupt practices going on with bogus conferences. Yes?
How do you sort out legitimate fees? Like some journals, if I'm going to have color illustrations or something, there's a fee for that.
Mm-hmm. Those are normally called page charges, and scholarly societies have done that and still do it. There's nothing unethical about a fee. There's nothing unethical about the article processing charge that is used to fund scholarly open access publishing. It's the other stuff that makes them bad. So the fee itself, charging a fee is not one of the criteria that I use. Both good people do that and bad people do it. So. Yes, sir, in the front.
Do you have your own lawyer representing you?
The university lawyer has been helping me out with lawsuits, but they told me they won't represent me when I report plagiarism, which I often do, if somebody decides to sue about that. The nice thing about reporting plagiarism is it's so cut and dry. You have a copy of the original document and you have a copy of the plagiarized document. Save them, make backup copies. You can't get sued for saying something that's true. So nobody's sued me about plagiarism, but the lawyer did respond to the threats that I've gotten, the threats to sue me. So they've been helping me. Yeah.
Jeffrey, thank you for being here. And thank you for taking my call months ago when I called you at your office and we talked about you coming here. Don't judge the importance of what you're doing by the attendance at the session. I'm going to ask if you could be interviewed for our newsletter. And next year, we're meeting in Colorado.
Oh, great!
And this is so critical and at the heart of what TAA is all about. This should be a plenary talk session for our whole community. This is amazing to have the node of an issue in our presence. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I get lots and lots of emails every day, and I have trouble keeping up with all, but it's fun. Yes?
I just wanted to say that I was actually in a professional development course this past spring semester, and my professor sent an email out to us with the New York Times article, and I read it, and I was like, what? I didn't even know this existed, and then now coming here and seeing you here, it's awesome, and I just really appreciate that you're doing this because I'm brand new into my field, or I will be an assistant professor in the fall, and I'm just very grateful that somebody is doing this.
Thank you very much. And the junior faculty, like I said, are the ones that they really target. So be very careful. Talk to senior colleagues about which are the best journals in your field, and avoid the bad ones, and resist the temptation to get an easy publication with a predatory publisher. Thank you.
I wanted to add also that you're really doing a fantastic service for tenure and promotion committees, because when you're trying to judge somebody's scholarly worth, and if they are publishing in these types of journals, we don't know everybody's journals that in their discipline. So it's fantastic that you're out there, and I didn't know that there was something like that out there that I could check on. So thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. And if you look at somebody's CV and you're not familiar with their field, you see these journal titles there, and they all look legitimate. You can't tell just by reading a CV. You have to examine each journal individually to determine its reputation.
I've been following your escapades on the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, you started out basically in science reviewing Is that correct?
I would read science books and review them for Library Journal, which is a journal that librarians use to decide which books to buy.
I'm from philosophy, and I've noticed that the idea of paying for stuff is starting to creep into philosophy, and also certain state presses are starting to require people to pay $1,000 or $2,000 to get a book published, and there's more vanity presses. Do you think there's a difference in the humanities versus the sciences?
Yes. One of the big differences is that research in the sciences is often grant-funded, and people put a line in the grant request to pay for the article processing charges. It doesn't happen in the humanities, in social sciences, and in the arts. So that's the main difference. So you either have to get your institution to pay the author fee or you have to pay it yourself. And so that's why the goal open access hasn't been very successful in those fields. Yeah.
I was just thinking of, like Brittany over here, I was like, oh, I'm so glad you told me this so I don't become a victim. But I was also thinking, now, I guess, do I need to start checking all my citations and my papers against your list? Because now I'm starting to also be concerned that I'm citing some of these bogus journals. Do you have any just advice on that? So that I can preserve the reputation of what I write.
Well, I would advise you to look at my list and avoid publishing in any publisher on there or any one of their journals. About going back and looking at your previous stuff, you might want to do that, and maybe not. If have you ever had to pay an author fee, an article processing charge to any one of these?
No, I haven't, and I'm not there yet. I'm
okay.
Just kind of getting started, and I was thinking more of it on the end of like the sources that I am citing,
mm-hmm.
and checking those out perhaps more carefully than I had thought of doing before.
Yeah, find out what the top journals are in your field and stick with them.
Related to that, do you think that there is some safety net through things like EBSCO? Because EBSCO is indexing some open access journals, but with these sorts of publishers that you're identifying, are EBSCO and the other aggregators picking them up?
Yes, they are. And the answer to your first question is no. Don't trust it just because it's indexed by a major abstracting and indexing service. They compete with each other. Scopus competes with EBSCO. And I go to their meetings at the American Library Association conference, and they always brag about how many journals they index. So that's a competitive element of their work. They want to say, we index more than they do. Buy our product. And that incentivizes them to err on the side of indexing things that they shouldn't even be touching. And they do that. There's lots of journals that are on my list that are indexed by EBSCO. So don't trust EBSCO for that purpose.
Promotion and Tenure Committee for a couple of years. And one of the things that I've seen in philosophy and humanities is the explosion of interdisciplinary journals. And this is partly a good thing. More and more young professors want to master philosophy and also maybe neuroethics or economics. And I need help finding out what's a good journal in these interdisciplinary fields. And it's difficult to know. Especially if it's a new journal, exactly the quality. And it tends to be a very small niche.
Mm.
It gets smaller and, you know, and like there's really only a few people in the area. And I can see it kind of maybe some of them crossing over into predatory. Do you have any advice for how to evaluate these interdisciplinary journals, especially if they're online?
Well, I would say use the criteria that I've established. That's the best one that I know of. One of the things, you talked about specific, really a narrow coverage, but on the other side of that, one of the things that the predatory publishers do, and this is one component of my criteria, is they have a very broad scope. They'll have journals like Journal of Medical Sciences or Journal of Humanities or Journal of Education, and the reason for that is they want to accept everything and make the money, so they have these really broad scopes, and they'll take anything as long as you pay the fee. In terms of interdisciplinary journals, I also look at predatory publishers that do even broader than what I just said. They'll say the Journal of Humanities and Social Sciences, or Journal of Medical Sciences and Humanities, or Journal of Business and Humanities. They try to combine different fields together in order to make their scope really broad and accept anything that comes in. How do you know what?
If you, one of the examples you mentioned, the invoice came at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the tenure promotion committee know whether a fee was charged or was paid?
Yeah, they not all of them hide their fee, and that's one of the things I look at. Some of them will state it clearly, even among the predatory publishers, because they know people are looking at that. It's not always possible for a P&T committee to know that. You have to go to their website and look and try and find the information, and some of them do hide it. And sometimes, even though they do mention it, it's really buried in the web page, so it can take a lot of work to find that information out. They don't want it to be the prominent thing. You know, you have to pay to publish here. They want to get you interested in publishing, and then they'll tell you about the fee when they have to. So any other questions? Thank you very much.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.